Well, as you ponder the probable fact that since we first began singing our last hymn, we have rotated around the Earth's axis about 40 miles, traveled around the sun about 3,000 miles, around the galaxy about 25,000 miles, and added another 75,000 around the Milky Way, I give you something else to ponder. At this very moment, hundreds, if not thousands, of preachers have just stepped into their pulpits and have begun preaching on Luke 24, 13 through 35. In fact, I can pretty much guarantee that if you stepped into St. Paul's, First Presbyterian, Main Street Methodist, Godfrey Congregational, or St. Peter and St. Paul, just to name a few of your neighbors, you would be hearing about what happened as Cleopas and the one who accompanied him on the road to Emmaus encountered but did not recognize Jesus until they sat at a table and broke bread with him. And that's because virtually all mainline churches, as well as the Roman Catholic Church, depend on the same or a very similar three-year cycle of readings to act as the foundation on which services and sermons are based each week. Having grown up in the Episcopal Church and having served two UCC churches in recent years, I have to admit that is my background as well. But not so the First Unitarian Church of Alton. Just for fun, I went back to the beginning of 2014 to see what texts were relied on by those who preached here, since you very kindly post your services online. And note that when I use the word text, I do not necessarily mean something based exclusively on the written word. Last week, for instance, it seems that a group of photographs provided the text. Just before Easter, the lyrics of a song gave the sermon its context. Earlier sermons relied on Buddhism, a Japanese writing, Oliver Sacks's journal, a reflection on a UU mission statement, you can tell, a discussion of some sociological and economic issues and the definition of class, as well as the issue of the environment. One sermon even featured football and the culture of sports. Not surprisingly, that was on Super Bowl Sunday. Jesus was referenced a couple of times on Easter Sunday, and once through the lens of the Iranian-American Muslim author Reza Aslan. But I don't think Hebrew scripture ever made it. It will today, but in its relationship to the writings of the Latin poet Lucretius, so don't get alarmed. Now, the reason I have chosen these texts to reflect on today is because I had the great fortune to attend a service here in early January when Kleber chose a book called The Swerve, How the World Became Modern by Stephen Greenblatt. Needless to say, I found it so compelling that I went to Hayner Library the very next day, and surprise, surprise, they actually had a copy, and I immediately checked it out. Now, I have to tell you that not only were Greek philosophy and Roman poetry not majors of mine, I never studied them at all. Oh, I'd heard of Lucretius and of Epicurus, but I was under the same incorrect assumption that many folks probably are, understanding that Epicurus was all about having a hot and tasty time in the old town tonight. So to hear of his amazing reflections on the structure of the universe, as well as his recommended lifestyle of calm, simplicity and serenity, focusing on maximizing the good, the true, and the beautiful, was quite surprising to me. To think that the ideas postulated by ancient Greek philosophers, such as Epicurus and before him Democritus and others, like those ideas involving the swerving of atoms, those basic building blocks of the universe into ever-changing entities which are responsible for all matter, to learn that these ideas were actually developed in the 5th and 4th century BCE was incredible to me. More incredible yet is that for centuries, their work was not only ignored, but held in such disdain that there was a concerted effort to destroy it. And sadly, because of fear and the necessity of consolidating and holding on to power, the church was a major player in its destruction. As Greenblatt points out, we owe what has survived to the tireless efforts of erudite book hunters of the early Middle Ages, like Poggio Bracciolini, who miraculously saved at least some of those ancient texts from extinction. Now, this got me to thinking, not just about atomism, but about the enormous impact of Greek philosophy and Hellenism in general in not just awakening humanist thought during the Enlightenment, but igniting it during the time that the Greeks were in control of the territories conquered under Alexander III of Macedonia, better known as Alexander the Great. As you may remember, Alexander, who was born in 356 BCE, succeeded his father Philip to the throne at the age of 20. And by the age of 30, had created one of the largest empires in the ancient world, stretching all the way from Greece to Egypt to Pakistan, including to, of course, Palestine. And along with Alexander's conquest came Hellenic culture. The Hellenistic age marked the transformation of Greek society from the localized and introverted city-states into an open, cosmopolitan, and at times exuberant culture that permeated the entire Mediterranean world and Southwest Asia. While the Hellenistic world incorporated a number of different people, Greek thinking, mores, and way of life dominated the public affairs of the time. All aspects of culture took on a Greek hue, with the Greek language being established as the official language of the Hellenistic world. But as the Jewish Encyclopedia states, by introducing Hellenic culture into Syria and Egypt, Alexander had probably more influence on the development of Judaism than any one individual, not a Jew by race. But curiously enough, there are no personal details which connect him to Jewish history, save that after the siege of Tyre in 332 BCE, he marched through Palestine unopposed, except in the case of Gaza, which was razed to the ground. Now, although rural life remained relatively unchanged in Palestine, cities such as Jerusalem rapidly adopted the Greek language, sponsored games and sports, and in more subtle ways, adopted and absorbed the culture of the Hellenes. Even the high priests bore such names as Jason and Menelaus. However, there was one exception to the Hellenizing process. Throughout it all, Jews retained staunch adherence to monotheism. Then after Alexander's death, his generals divided and subsequently fought over the empire. In 301 BCE, Ptolemy took direct control of the Jewish homeland, but he made no serious attempt to interfere in its religious affairs. Ptolemy's successors were in turn supplanted by the Seleucids, and that attitude of non-interference ended with Antiochus IV, who was thrown out by the Maccabees. And this led to about 100 years of home rule under the Hasmonean dynasty until finally Rome conquered Judea in 63 BCE. Now, as it turns out, one of the most obvious signs of the enduring influence of the Hellenistic period throughout all of this time frame can be discerned in the early literature of that new faith, Christianity, which developed in the first century of the Common Era. Though Rome ruled Judea for about 100 years before the first gospel was produced, because the New Testament was written not in Latin, but in Greek, we can see how important Greek language remained. So this got me to thinking. If this Hellenic influence was as strong as the historical evidence indicates, doesn't it seem likely that some of the actual texts in the Hebrew Bible reflect some Hellenic influence as well? Do you know, hardly anything has been written about that. I never heard it referenced at Eden Seminary, even though the Old Testament Hebrew Bible was my major. And when I asked Kleber about it, he didn't remember any discussion of this possibility, probability either. And so I opened my Bible and went on the hunt, so to speak. It didn't take long. Two definite possibilities quickly emerged. The book of Ecclesiastes, which I read earlier, and the Song of Songs, also known as the Song of Solomon, which appear back to back in the so-called writings section of the Bible. Not in Torah, not in Prophets, but in that group of materials which includes Proverbs, Psalms, and the book of Job. For me, it seems both clear and arguable that both Song of Songs and Ecclesiastes, in spite of their respective allusions to a connection to David or Solomon, were written in direct conversation with the thoughts and arguments of such Greek philosophers as Epicurus. One, the Song of Songs, pretty explicitly, although metaphorically too, celebrates the joys of sexual union. And the other, Ecclesiastes, seems to reflect on what Lucretius so aptly named on the nature of things. By the way, I have to tell you that scholars have never quite come to a unified conclusion as to just when these two books were written. And the ascribing of influential writing to former esteemed leaders was a very common practice at the time, so that in no way the mention of either David or Solomon need be taken as conclusive evidence of that particular dating. But as I mentioned earlier, because throughout it all, Jews continued to be devout believers in the one God, the swerve of Greek thought became suspended in a mixture of pre-existent monotheistic thinking to become the biblical slurry we know and love. Well, at least some of us do. Now, frankly, it seems to be that, at least to me, it seems to be that life is all about swerves and slurries. I would define swerves not only as unexpected, unpredictable movements of matter, but unexpected, unpredictable movements of experience, both actual and perceived, which somehow have to be incorporated into what already exists. Think of your lives here together as church. Churches, to me, are prime examples of slurries. In a thriving church, new folks are always swerving to bring their thoughts, their gifts, their past experiences, as well as their hopes and dreams into the mix. How did your first discovering the First Unitarian Church of Alton affect you? How did swerving into membership here change your life, the church? How did this already affect the slurry of your life that you brought here? New friends, new opportunities for intellectual, spiritual, missional growth, all mixing around together in what you brought to share, but new challenges too. As you look ahead, you will face the same pressures as the ancients did. You too will have to decide which of your traditions, what of your thinking, what rights can be open to the swerves of change and culture. But what are your tenets as a community of faith that can never be sacrificed? Think about it. In closing, I consider myself blessed to have swerved among you today, and I wish you the best for the future. I know there's things that you're worried about, and I will keep you in my prayers. So be it.